The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, along with Shanali Basak, here in our Interactive Broker studio. Let's get to a little bit more on COVID and the vaccine, because top of mind, Shanali mentioned it earlier. We've got President Bush, his push to begin offering third doses of Pfizer's vaccine, facing the first of two crucial tests. Advisors to the FDA meeting today to talk about whether booster shots should be offered to most Americans. So the process moving forward today, we are expecting some type of vote expected later this afternoon. So let's see what's top of mind for Dr. Ian Lusbader. He's clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone. He joins us once again on the phone in New York City. Hey, Ian, good to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm good. Happy Friday and welcome back, Carol. We missed you.
Thank you. Thank you. I got a needed break and it's good to be back. But I do feel like so many of the same stories that I left are still here, understandably so. How do you see the way forward when it comes to this pandemic? You and I and Tim and our team have been talking to you a lot. What's next here?
So there's a big debate about the third dose or the, or the booster dose for COVID. And, you know, who, what, and when is really the question. A lot of this data is based on Israel, where, you know, they had a relationship with Pfizer. And they got their vaccines very early, really December and January, if not earlier last year. So it's been almost a year, and what they are noting is really the effectiveness of the vaccine is dropping from about 90% to about 55%, and that's both due to dropping antibody levels, which we know happens after a while, and also mutations, you know, in the virus. This was to the Alpha variant. The Delta variant actually has a different conformation of the spike protein. And so based on a number of issues, including a much higher viral load with Delta, people are asymptomatic and often have very, very high levels. So that's really what we're seeing. And
so is this more about concern about transfer? I mean, in other words, you're not getting sick, but you now have ability to pass COVID around?
Yes, I think that's certainly one of the elements. Okay. So that's really what we're seeing in Israel, and really what we're seeing here is that the majority of people who've been vaccinated are not getting very sick at all. A small percent are, and in Israel and here as well, the small percent of people who've been vaccinated, actually in Israel it's about half the hospitalized patients had two vaccines, they typically have, you know, heart disease or lung disease, diabetes, hypertension. They have a number of other issues. And So it is likely, if we're going to do a booster, it should be in those susceptible groups. You know, we know the third vaccine really does raise antibodies. The question is, does it change anything?
Right.
Will it really change hospitalization and death rates? So that's really the question. And then the question also comes up, what about side effects or potential side effects,
so,
you know, months or years down the line?
So what do you make of the meeting today of the FDA advisors and what will come out of it? How fast can we expect decisions to be made by the Biden administration and then guidance given to the bulk of the country?
You know, candidly, I think we need more data. We really should have been all along the way doing a variety of our own studies, both on the mRNA vaccines and patient populations, monoclonal antibodies, other drugs and other treatments, you know, for COVID. We really should be a leader instead of relying on other data. My bet is that they are going to say it's absolutely reasonable for people, the immunocompromised, people with underlying diseases. But I think they're going to wait on advising it for a big group of people. First of all, we know a lot of people now really have very high antibody levels, you know, and what we don't know is will even higher antibody levels really make a significant difference. Before we subject people to the potential risk of a third vaccine, we really should know, does a higher antibody level really change an outcome? That's really the question.
This was a really big week with so many people going back to school.
Right.
So what are you expecting for the next couple of weeks? Does that mean that there may be a lot more cases? And does that really start to change the calculus of how people think about this disease?
You know, even though we're getting closer to what we used to think of herd immunity is, right, 70, 80, 90% vaccinations, 75% of Americans have had at least one vaccine. There's a group of about 50 or 60 million people who, you know, remain unvaccinated, although slowly that's seeming to chip down. I think we are going to continue to see a rise in COVID cases, really, in the unvaccinated. And I think everyone ultimately is going to be exposed to Delta. It's highly contagious. But I think most people who are vaccinated will have either minimal or no symptoms. They'll have a cough, they'll have a cold, and if they don't get tested, they may never even really know. And I think eventually we will all build up antibodies to that. And unless there's a new mutation, I think we will sort of learn to live with Delta, you know, once that group of 50 million people, you know, wind up getting it. Now, of course, there will be some hospitalizations and deaths in the unvaccinated, but that at this point is a relatively small percent of the population.
Well, and it is interesting, I thought, the point you made about a third dose. We don't necessarily know all the side effects of getting one, and that's just something to consider as they move forward, certainly regulators. Dr. Lesbader, sit tight. We'll come back. Dr. Ian Lesbader, we are talking with on this Friday. He's clinical professor of medicine over at NYU Langone Medical Center, on the phone in New York City. Are you ready, Shanali, to get a third booster?
I would like it as soon as possible.
You sound like Tim. Tim would be like, I want it yesterday. I do like that they're gathering more information, because I think we're getting pieces from different parties. And, you know, we know, right, data is important to really understanding maybe what's to come.
Definitely.
And what's the best move.
Definitely. But people are back in full force.
It definitely feels it.
Else.
It definitely feels it. All right, you are listening to Bloomberg Business Week on this Friday. Carol Masser, Shanali Basak, and we'll be back in just a moment right here on Bloomberg Radio. Let's get right back to Dr. Ian Lesbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone, still with us on the phone in New York City. So, Dr. Lesbader, one thing that really caught my attention when you said, you know, we don't know the side effects of a third possible dose. I mean, we are still learning in real time about these vaccines and about, you know, the impact it has on our body. What are the concerns that kind of an overdosing of a COVID vaccine could mean?
So, you know, everything in life is a risk and a benefit ratio, whatever decisions we make. And certainly being unprotected against COVID is not a smart thing to do, because we do know that about a third of patients have long COVID. So we do our best to protect. The issue was raised about influenza, absolutely. Flu shots, although not perfectly effective, certainly can be very helpful. You know, we're starting to give that now, so that's important. We certainly know the two vaccines really reduce, for COVID, certainly reduce the risk of death and hospitalization. We don't know that much about the third vaccine. We certainly know a small percentage of people who get the mRNA shots can have other issues, myocarditis, pericarditis, there are neurologic issues. Yes, it is a very small number. And overall, the benefit of the vaccine overrides really the risks. Mm. But people should know that these are not risk-free vaccines.
Importantly,
side effects can occur.
Importantly, also, the vaccines are different, and differences are emerging across them. How do you parse what's most important when it comes to differences between the vaccines themselves?
So at this point, it does look like the Moderna mRNA vaccines really do give a little bit longer lasting protection. Part of that might be the time interval, right? So initially we were giving a 3-week interval between a Pfizer and 4 weeks with the Moderna. It does turn out that maybe that gap between the first two shots really can give you longer lasting protection. J&J initially did not have numbers quite as high, but over time it does seem to help. And that also seems to be boosted if you give an mRNA vaccine several weeks or months after the J&J. So it does look like for the majority of people, of healthy people, they are pretty well protected. I want to say, with or without approval at this point, people can go into, you know, local pharmacies. I've got patients who get third vaccines. Right. It really, so there's no one preventing that, but it really has to be a recommendation based on the science behind it. And I don't think we really know, other than saying that vulnerable people, elderly, diabetes, immunosuppressed, there the risk of getting Delta and complications are much higher than your average person who's otherwise healthy, who has already had two vaccines.
Katie Greifeld was on with me yesterday at Bloomberg, and she, Shanali, actually talked about people she knows who just walked into pharmacies and were like, I need a shot. It was her third shot, and they just did it.
It happened to me in front of me the other day.
Did it?
Yes.
So we know it's happening. Well, go ahead,
absolutely.
Ian, please.
People, if they want to get it, can do it. And people who don't want vaccines, obviously we're not yet forcing people to do that in the United States.
Yeah.
But I think we should wait for more data. And I don't think there's an emergency at this point. If you're otherwise healthy, it is not a panic to get a third booster at this time.
Hey, real quickly, 30 seconds here. China can't seem to get a break. There is somewhere where there's tons of people, lots of vaccines have been given out. They can track data points like no other. Probably country. Their problems tell you what about this virus? And again, just got about 30 seconds.
Well, I'm not sure how effective the Sinovac vaccine really is. Okay. And they may be having other mutations that they're not testing for. We need to do a better job in general. There are new nasal vaccines for COVID that are being worked on. There are a lot of different approaches that we really need to make efforts that may be equally or more effective for new mutations. The data out of China could be a new mutation, or it could just be a less effective vaccine.
All right. Good. Great. Always. Ian, thank you, thank you, thank you. Have a wonderful and safe weekend. Dr. Ian Lospader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone, on the phone in New York City. The more I learn, the more I feel like I don't know.
Yeah,
but
I feel
he helps
the same
so
exact
much.
Way.
He does help clarify a lot, though.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we often reference something being a great business school case study. We do that a lot here on Bloomberg Business Week. Case studies, now part of business school's efforts to improve diversity. Let's get into it. It's all part of the coverage of Bloomberg Business Week's annual survey and coverage of the world's top MBA program. So let's get into it with Bloomberg Business Week editor Jill Weber here in our Interactive Broker studio. And also with us, Bloomberg News higher education finance reporter Janet Lauren on the phone in New York City. Case studies right at the heart of getting an MBA. MBA, and yet.
Yeah, well, and it is a topic that we think about at the magazine a lot. I liken some of our most noteworthy stories to sort of our versions of case studies. And so I thought this was a really interesting story that Janet was able to contribute to the package, because you go to business school, what do you learn?
Shanali.
That's to me.
Well,
let's see how well it did.
The case study is really the DNA of that experience, right? And as we've all known for the past, from all of our amazing reporting from the past year, it's like, oh, right, this is a lot of white and male stuff, right? So,
exactly.
So let's shake up the case study, right? So, Shanali, what does that end up looking like?
Oh, well, what's so interesting, and I'm curious to see what Janet found here, but to the point, there are a lot of, if you're going into retail, you'll find more case studies where women have become the CEO, turn things around. But when it comes to other more hardcore areas of finance where women have not really dominated yet, like quant finance, I mean, even the class, it was like two women in most of my classes. So, and very few case studies that involve women, because the women have not risen to the CEO level in those industries yet. So, Janet, how are they changing this?
Well, it doesn't have to be the CEO to be a compelling character in a case study. For example, the one we mentioned in our story was Rosalind Fox of John Deere, the tractor agriculture manufacturer. And she was the first Black woman manager of a factory. And that was a compelling enough reason for Harvard to feature her as a case study.
That's what I thought was interesting. I think I always think about case studies as being these huge, big blow-ups or problems, or, you know, it's usually involving the C-suite and the CEO or something. But as you point out, there are some really great stories, case studies, and lessons to be learned by people, certainly diversity and diverse people, maybe lower on, you know, the career ladder.
But they're still leaders, and they're still facing challenges, and they're still dealing with issues and problems. And it's, you know, you can learn as much from somebody who may not be the CEO by listening to their experience. And if you read the case study of Rosalind Fox, you know, you could hear about the isolation she, you know, she experienced while living in a small town of in Wisconsin of 6,000 people. And she was recruited by John Deere, and, you know, that was one of the things she was concerned about in going and taking the job. In another case study we mentioned, Stanford, in addition to Harvard, has been doing a lot of outreach and just asking their alumni and asking faculty members to reach out and find other potential protagonists with diverse backgrounds. And Stanford featured, you know, a woman who runs a car dealership, a Black woman who runs a car dealership in Dayton, Ohio. And she's the second generation running that car dealership. And, you know, that was an interesting case study for Stanford.
You know, which bears mentioning, Stanford number one in our ranking of MBA MBA schools and programs.
Here's my big question. So interesting. Stanford number one in networking, number one in compensation. Such great things, but they're not among the top 10 when it comes to diversity. I don't want to be super tough on these business schools because I've got to say they're not doing horrible, right? I mean, they are top 20. I've got to say, when I went to business school, I was more pleased with the diversity than I was even in college. So, Joel, how did you guys even think about how to approach diversity in these programs as you guys did this for the first time?
Well, the it's all driven by survey, right? And so it ends up being thousands and thousands and thousands of surveys. And that is our data point, right? Like, whatever those responses are, or what we build that around, recognizing that this was such an important thing that we wanted to actually help acknowledge, and the schools are recognize that there's a challenge here, but they're also doing things about it. And that's what we effectively, you know, centered the survey questions on. But, you know, what that ties into, I think, is also what this article of Janet's reflect, which is that case study about John Deere didn't come from a professor, right? Who did it come from, Janet?
It came from a student. And that student said, I want to be reflected in these case studies. And she, you know, she spoke up and she suggested Rosalind Fox. Rosalind was not her manager, but she was someone who mentored her at John Deere. And lo and behold, she became a case study. And Harvard is mandating in its required first-year MBA courses that every course have a protagonist with a diverse background.
So what I like about that, it just shows this relationship that I think the business schools are really – they're leaning into their own students, right? And they recognize that their own students can help them solve these problems. And that surfaces new material that they wouldn't otherwise have been able to have. So I just thought that was a really, really clever insight into what makes business schools also special, right? And like we've gone to so many of these business schools together, and it's like that network, that is the network effect, right?
Totally.
You put all these people together and you talk about the problems and solutions and you create better leaders out of it.
Right, exactly. What's interesting is we talk about brands all the time and how customers are pushing brands and companies, right, to be more diverse or more sensitive to the environment. What's interesting though, Janet, is a student pushing this, you know, to get a more diverse case study. Yet in your story, you point out that it might be unclear whether professors will embrace it equally. What did you hear about that?
So the professor that I spoke with at UCLA had talked about how, you know, like a decade ago in a psychology course, he had brought in diverse people in his discussions and case studies, and he said students were wondering, well, why are you including this? It just doesn't really feel relevant. And now, a decade later, you know, students are really asking for it. But the question is, look, if you're a business school professor and you've been teaching a class for decades, you know, you that adds more work for you to change out your case studies. You know, it's a lot of work to find case studies to teach them. And they may not want to switch up their courses if, you know, you've got an oldie but goodie, you know, who's going to replace that? And it takes effort on that time.
Unless students keep answering these surveys that you're doing, Joel, well, and saying, this is what we want.
You know, that's exactly right. And it's also why we've continued to just champion this ranking, because, like, the students end up being the engine that drives it. They become alumni. The alumni also are a big part of who takes part in these surveys. The more you do that, the more it actually helps everything gel.
Well, we're going to have more offshoots of certainly the Business Week coverage in the magazine. That's in weeks to come. Joel Weber, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Editor of Bloomberg Business Week here in our studio. Janet Lauren, check her out at Janet Lauren on Twitter. Higher education finance reporter at Bloomberg News. You can find her story, too, at businessweek.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get into it, our check on the cryptocurrency world. We've got a company that is developing digital tools to merge the traditional capital markets and crypto assets. Here to tell us more, and Shanali and I have been talking behind the scenes. We have a million questions for Alex Lindberg. He's CEO of Nymbus. He's on the phone in New York City. Alex, so great to have you here with Shanali and myself. First of all, I've been reading about your company, and I'm going to be quite honest with you. I'm a little confused. So tell me exactly what you guys do.
So, good afternoon, ladies, and thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure. I think that this is only a 10-minute segment, so a million questions is going to be pretty tough. I'll try to speak.
We'll have you back quick. Again.
So what do we do? We are firmly fixed in providing solutions within the decentralized finance space. What does that really just mean? In layman's terms, all of the things that we've been doing, in the centralized, standardized general financial services space, in the lending space, in the traditional, trading space, we're going to be looking to do exactly the same things and leveraging what the team's, multiple decades, I would say at least every single leader on this team has at least 3 decades in the centralized, standardized financial services space.
So
we're looking to bring that experience to the decentralized space. What does
Alex,
that really mean?
So decentralized finance, one way I try to explain it to people, and tell me how you make the comparison, decentralized finance reminds me a lot of peer-to-peer lending, where there's a human being on the other side somewhere. How does this actually work, and how do you compare it to just peer-to-peer lending like we've seen the last several years?
Right. So peer-to-peer lending is one component of decentralized finance, right? And that's also how we're starting, from the tools designs that we're implementing. So we're actually provided 2 main apps, right? One that's for lending and borrowing, through peer-to-peer, and also the exchange of currency off exchange, so that we don't have any fees associated with it. And also, because we're not an exchange, we're doing it off exchange. It's impossible to hack us, right? So there's a great risk metrics there. But from a peer-to-peer perspective, there's very little difference between what decentralized finance and peer-to-peer is providing versus what the last 2 decades of the lending clubs and the Prospers that they've done, except they've done it off-chain and we're doing it on-chain. Right?
So why is it better?
So I'll tell you, fees.
Ultimately,
if we think about all of the decentralized activity that we've seen over the last 20 or so years, starting from, me no longer having to call a broker in order to get an execution or to get a quote, right? When that decentralization happened and we started being able to trade from our phones and our laptops without having to make that call, remember, transparency was a big part of that, but also primarily it was the fees that drove that.
But
right? If I don't have to use a broker, I can do the same things without those fees, and that's driving this industry as well.
This sounds so magical: lower fees, peer-to-peer lending. But the reality too is there's a lot of risk involved. How do you get comfortable with lending and borrowing to people you don't know without FDIC insurance? By the way,
Like, where's the oversight? Who's
overseeing
you?
You can lose it all.
Right, right. So I'm very happy you said that, because, look, one of the reasons I keep harping on the fact that the leadership of this team has spent their lifetime. You know, I've spent 27 years in the standardized centralized financial service. The reason I keep harping on that is because you're right. There is a tremendous amount of risk, inherent risk, in doing it on chain or off chain. Right. The reason why it's so important to pick products that are being developed by folks with our level of experience is that we're not looking to dethrone traditional finance, right? We're not looking, there are no, you know, to us, you know, the standardized, generalized, centralized banking sector, they're not the enemy. And let's be realistic, ladies. You know, just because we're calling it a disruption, just because we're calling it, as an industry, decentralization move, doesn't mean that this traditional banking institutions and alternative assets institutions are not going into this space. They are going to go into this space very, very heavily, and they bring with them a tremendous amount of experience and liquidity. So we're actually providing that level of experience and oversight to the community as well.
Alex, just quickly, got about 40 seconds left here. I mean, my understanding is you guys are moving towards a listing on a North American stock exchange. So is the plan, or maybe is it ultimately that you end up being linked up, bought out by, merged with one of the traditional financial Wall Street houses? And again, just quickly.
So I'll tell you, being a compliance officer for many years, there's no way that I could actually even speak to that. But I am going to tell you that you are right, that we are moving very heavily to bring in a KYC and AML and get registered in the state, or for global purposes.
All right.
Because we do feel that there's a good balance to actually do that. But yes, that's certainly the direction that we're
going. All right. We still have 999,000 questions to ask you, but we'll do that next time. Alex, thanks so much. Alex Lemberg, CEO at Nymbus, on the phone in New York City.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, say you crazy.
Just drive, baby.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get to it. We've just got about 9 minutes left in today's trading session. We're hovering around our worst levels of the day. We are on track for a second down week when it comes to U.S. equities. Let's get to it with Ryan Kelly, Senior VP, Portfolio Manager of Hennessy Funds, with us on the phone in Raleigh, North Carolina. Among the funds he helps manage, the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund, up about 11% year to date, putting it in the 82nd percentile among its peers. That's according to Bloomberg data. Ryan, the energy story is certainly one that we've been watching this week. How are you, and how do you see that group?
Hi, good to be on again. Good to hear from you. And the group, utility group, has certainly been lagging this year, last year as well. But that's usually the time when we think it starts to get a little bit more interesting. This is a group that we like for many reasons. It has good dividend yields. It has a nice long-term projection of earnings. It's pretty stable earnings. These are companies that we need no matter what. It's a central part of the economy. And yes, they have been sort of pushed to the side last year and this year. But this also makes it, at this point, a much more compelling valuation. They're trading at about a 3-multiple discount to the S&P 500. Generally, they actually trade just a slight premium to the S&P. There's been so much money going into all the other sectors of the market. Into last year was all about large cap. It was about technology. This year, some of the sectors that really got hammered last year, such as financials and energy, they've come flying back this year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, something like utilities, we think is still a really good long-term holding for long-term investors.
So how much are you rushing to safety now? You made this comment about how these are companies that will do well no matter what. We've seen a few days of slight pullbacks in the S&P in the last week or so. Are you looking for safety now?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen a little pullback. We're still only about 2.5% off the highs, give or take. This is such a resilient market. It's hard to tell, you know, if we are going to have that next big correction that everybody talks about. And, you know, we've seen it again and again for the last year. Every time that there's a pullback, it takes, on average, 5 days to hit a new high. You know, things seem a little different maybe this time, but potentially not. No, this is more of I like to talk about utilities in this space a little bit more long-term right now in that we are entering – there is the defensive side, which you mentioned, but we're entering really the first innings, I'd say, of a very, very long-term transformative expansion for many of these companies, driven by clean energy, driven by new technologies, driven by electrification. If we are going to get to a space, a place where we have, you know, say, many more electric vehicles on the road and many more appliances being, you know, using electricity, I've seen studies that show that we're going to need an electrical grid which is 2 times bigger than it is right now.
Which means what? Good things for natural gas.
It means good things for a few different things. We have in this fund, we have utilities in general, so it's really good for electric utilities. This is a long-term runway of growth. And utilities in general, whether it's natural gas or electric, these are the companies that when they invest in their infrastructure, this infrastructure, huge word right now, when CapEx goes up, longer-term earnings per share go up. It causes growth rate and earnings per share when they have to spend more to reinvest in their infrastructure and to get bigger.
Is there, Ryan, one thing I do wonder, though, increasingly, Shanali knows it, she covers it, she talks about it all the time about, you know, ESG on Wall Street among institutional investors, you know, looking for kind of a greener way forward. Greener, it's a little vague, I think, right now, because there aren't really true standards out there when it comes to regulators and what it means. But, I mean, do you see in the near future that you're going to have to pivot more because institutional investors will demand it, investors will demand it, that your investments reflect a cleaner way forward when it comes to the impact on the environment?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly that pressure that's happening already, and that's not only from institutional investors and other investors. It's also from the companies themselves. Many utilities themselves, they are pushing for whether or not the government is, politically we're moving that way or not. They are pushing for net zero type emissions by 2050. Duke Energy down in my area, for instance. So that movement is happening, and that does mean a whole lot of investment for many decades to come. I think personally, the way that we believe is that it's going to be really hard to go to straight on full renewables, and natural gas is a very good complementary energy source to renewables because, you know, there are certain times when we have to have large scale, quickly turned on electricity generation. And natural gas is a very good way to do that.
You know, you own Berkshire as well.
That stood out for me, too.
I know. Carol and I love watching the Berkshire bets. What do you want Warren Buffett to be doing with all that extra money?
Well, it's an interesting question. So the way that this fund is run, it is a fund which is primarily invested in any company, most 95% of companies that are natural gas distribution companies. Now, Berkshire Hathaway obviously does not sound like one at all, but they have a very, you know, large company within their structure called MidAmerican, which is a utility company, an energy company. So that's why it's in the fund. And it happens to be, you know, market cap weighted fund, so it's one of the largest holdings in the fund.
Well, good to get some time with you. This is certainly a topic we've been talking a lot about more generally when it comes to energy and just kind of watching some real hot spots around the world when it comes to energy crunches. Ryan, thank you so much. Ryan Kelly, he's portfolio manager at Hennessy Funds, on the phone from Raleigh.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.